You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of February 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
For me, the reaction that people have had towards the Canadian delegation and myself, whether I'm wearing traditional clothing or a suit and tie, has been extremely encouraging in the Indo-Canadian friendship.
Canada's Prime Minister explains what he was got up as on his visit to India. My guests Chiara Ramella, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Daniel Bache will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the reasons that the European Union might be the real winner of Italy's imminent election, a global gathering of mayoralty, and as the UK discusses the abolition of the plastic drinking straw, what would our panel ban if endowed with the necessary power? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today, at least initially, are Monocle's Chiara Ramella and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Daniel Bache will be joining us presently, but for now, Chiara and Henry, welcome both. We will start with Italy, which votes next weekend in a general election. For most of the rest of the world, the key point of interest is a potential comeback by the bizarrely inextinguishable Silvio Berlusconi, who, although not eligible to actually stand, what with being a convicted criminal, hopes to position himself as the power behind the throne. For Italy, however, the election will be interesting as a measure of the country's current attitudes towards the EU, which is less popular in Italy than ever, but many of the country's political parties seem to think otherwise. Chiara, you are here, of course, as usual, to speak on behalf of the entire population of Italy. Apparently, only 36% of your fellow citizens believe that membership of the EU is a good thing. That is down from 80% at the start of the 1990s. Why is that? Why have your people gone all Eurosceptic?
Mainly because of austerity, obviously, which is something that was leading the anti-European sentiment for the last few years. I think the gripe against the EU has changed in its nature over the past few years because austerity was felt across all of the southern Europe and Mediterranean mm-hmm. region by many different countries. I think Italy specifically has had to deal with the issues of integrating immigrants coming from the routes through the Mediterranean, and the overwhelming sentiment there is a sense of abandonment from the EU. So I think most of the gripe now stands with a sense of being completely left alone to deal with a mess that nobody else wants to pick up.
So do you think the nature of the gripe has evolved from being largely about austerity to largely about immigration?
I think both exist and coexist, but I think the latter is now what's shaping most of the resentment towards the EU.
Henry, you were about to leap in there with a question or a point or a violent objection.
It was actually exactly the question that you asked. So I don't need to ask any further questions. But I will make the observation off the back of that it would be fascinating to be able to kind of A/B test nations' reactions to the EU based on different economic, political, social, external factors. I mean, if Britain, for example, was in a structural economic relationship to the EU, which resembled something more like a Mediterranean country, you know, how would that have interplayed with the migratory concerns, which I think it's pretty well established, was at the forefront of a lot of voters' minds in the 2016 vote to leave the European Union. You know, how do they intersect? It's difficult for me to be able to kind of map that onto the British collective consciousness, so far as I'm aware of it. And so it'd be fascinating, yeah, to hear from you kind of how those interplay in people's minds.
But I think what's interesting is this idea of consciousness and what people understand their own nation's relationship with the EU to be like. I think the way that Britain understands itself in relation to the EU is very different from what Italy understands itself in relation to EU as. You know, the Troika, as it's called often in Italy, is felt as this mother who tells you off because you've been lazy and you haven't paid your bills in time. That's very different from the kind of resentment that Britain had expressed against the EU, which was basically the whole idea behind the Brexit campaign was that the EU was holding Britain back and not that it was telling it off for something that it hadn't done. While that's the sentiment that Italy has always expressed against the EU. So it's like being a child that's been told off and not really wanting to be told off anymore.
So that being the case, why are so many of Italy's political parties, if there is this huge wellspring of Euroscepticism at large in the country, why are they becoming notably less strident about the EU the closer the vote gets?
Because I think people realise, because I think Italy is at heart actually quite a conservative country in the way that I think it is scared of going at it alone. I don't think it has the same bravado that the UK manages to muster for itself and the self-image that it portrays itself as. I think Berlusconi, for example, has somewhat shifted his attitude towards the EU, becoming a lot more kind of pro-EU over the course of the campaign specifically, because he's trying to portray himself as the only solution to the chaos that we all know will happen on the 5th of March, because there is no way that this election is going to have a clean-cut result. He's presenting himself as the only force of reason and of calm in this sea of chaos. And that also coincides with making good with the EU, kind of staying true to the pillars of continuity. I think that's what he's trying to portray himself as. And the EU is part of that. And that's why a lot of the more revolutionary tendencies, including calling for a referendum, calling to get out of the euro, have slightly died down, because people are afraid. And I think also the results of the Brexit referendum and the way that that situation is playing out has scared Italy, because austerity hit the country so hard, and for it to be finally getting slowly out of it in the last year or so, and the mere possibility of a contraction of the economy is terrifying for the many people who have just about managed to kind of try to start turning it around together again.
So what you're telling us is that Berlusconi is essentially a kind of patrician wise father figure in this election.
A lot of people abroad don't understand what Berlusconi means to Italian people.
No, we don't. I think literally none of us abroad understand what Berlusconi means to the Italian people. Let's have it.
And I think it is true. For many in the country, he represents this idea of familiarity, of continuity. And yes, that old figure of, yeah, the patrician, as you said, there is a sense of... there's an idea that he's just never going to ever die and ever leave the scene, because he's part of the furniture at this point, pretty much.
Well, let's take a look now at Canada, the Prime Minister of which, Justin Trudeau, finds himself grappling with a hitherto unfamiliar sense that not everybody finds him charming. His visit to India has not been an outstanding success, blighted by a snub, whether real or perceived, by India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, a dinner invitation by the Canadian delegation to an alleged Sikh extremist, and a measure of local ridicule generated by Trudeau's insistence on dressing up in local costume. This is what I specifically want to examine, which is the recurring habit of and it's always Western leaders travelling to non-Western countries who, for some reason, feel obliged to rig up in local kit. We are joined now by Daniel Baich, representing in the studio the entire population of Canada. And speaking as a representative of your people, Daniel, how do you feel about these photos of your nation's leader wearing what he is wearing in them?
Oh, it's hilarious. It's so good. Why he figures he needs to turn up at every possible occasion wearing Indian wedding garb is beyond everyone.
See, the thing is, I feel a measure of sympathy for him in that I vaguely thought initially that he may have been a victim of the same practical joke, not really, that I was myself on the receiving end of some years ago. I used to go out with a woman of Indian descent. We were visiting Calcutta. There was a family wedding to which we were invited. So various relatives of hers made a great fuss of making sure that I was, you know, correctly attired and took me out shopping for a splendid, yeah, I have to say, sort of flowing embroidered shirt, which I still do own. And obviously, inevitably, I get to the wedding and every other bloke there is wearing a suit and tie and just looking at me thinking, what have you come as?
You know what? That was exactly Prime Minister Trudeau's experience when he met Bollywood stars. He shows up in a Sherwani and, you know, look, and everyone's like, why, who, where's the wedding? And everyone else is wearing black tie and suits.
I was interested because Daniel actually circulated before the show an extremely instructive picture slideshow of other Western leaders dressed in various...
I am looking at it now.
They are
magnificent.
Do you agree though, Andrew, that there is something... They're not quite as preposterous as Trudeau, in my opinion. And I was racking my brains to try and think, have I seen Western leaders in non-Western garb on official trips before? Couldn't think of any, but you sent that round, and I realised I'd actually seen dozens. I think that there's something about Trudeau's particularly saccharine character that just makes it that bit more intolerable. Do you agree?
Yeah, when you see Barack Obama in, you know, a nice Japanese shirt, his character and something about how light he is in these situations, you're like, oh, okay, that works. But Trudeau is sincerely trying to impress people in this sense, I think. And he shows up thinking he's doing some good,
Why is the dynamic, do we think, oh, I will put this to you, Chiara, because Berlusconi, who you were just explaining to us, does himself have a bit of form for this kind of thing.
Absolutely.
I have seen the pictures. But it's always a west to east thing. You know, when an eastern leader visits my homeland of Australia, they don't feel obliged to put on a hat with corks hanging off it and a blue singlet. Narendra Modi, if he visited Canada, would not put on a scarlet tunic and a broad-brimmed hat. And I think people would think it was a bit weird if he did, or if the Prime Minister of Japan turned up in Vancouver dressed as a lumberjack. Why do they do it, Chiara? Why, and why is the traffic always that one way?
Why do they do it? I guess to try and express some degree of connection. I don't think it's something that they should do. But it seems to evoke a sense of familiarity and a sense of an attempt to connect with the local custom that frankly just reeks a little bit of post-colonialism, doesn't it?
On that potentially inflammatory note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Chiara Ramella, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Daniel Bache. Coming up next, what is, because Lord knows I've looked, the collective noun for a group of mayors?
Monocle's stately March installment comes with a decided South Korean flavour. We sit down with President Moon Jae-in to talk Trump, troublesome neighbours, and taking the time to watch TV with his cat, no less. Plus, we dedicate a 48-page survey to an in-depth look at South Korea through the chefs, artists, entrepreneurs, and designers shaping it. Elsewhere, we profile the key players searching for positive solutions in Jerusalem, meet the sharp minds making a point in the pencil industry, and augur the year ahead in art from New York, London, and Hong Kong. In the design pages, we mark the rise of timber towers from France to the US and bed down in the bedazzling dorms of a Copenhagen college that has us mulling over the merits of heading back to school. All before a breeze around the world's biggest outerwear fair, ISPO in Munich. And we chew over Paris's freshest new food shop. Monocle's March issue is out now and available on all good newsstands or by subscription.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Chiara Ramella, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Daniel Bache. Now, regular readers of Monocle magazine, and that new issue is out now, will be aware that we are, as an organisation, a big fan of mayors. Mayors often being the people actually getting stuff done and governing and so on, while national leaders are standing awkwardly in front of tourist attractions in rented costumes. The Global Covenant of Mayors met in Brussels this week, celebrating its 10th anniversary, which we are now going to use as a LGBTQ to discuss mayors in general. Daniel, we will start with you because Toronto's recent and indeed now late mayor, mm-hmm. Rob Ford, was somebody we did end up talking about quite a lot here at Monocle 24. He did put Toronto on the map, as it were, but does he now basically loom in the collective memory as an example of how not to be a mayor?
Absolutely.
100%. I think he set the standard for the worst possible mayorship you could carry out, and misstep after misstep. I mean, totally took away from the agenda at City Hall as well. There's no other word to describe it but circus. It was insane.
Weren't there some significant kind of legislative triumphs, though? I've forgotten now, but wasn't he considered to be quite a good actual policy man before his personal life started going downhill?
Taxes, yeah. He got some tax stuff. A lot of spending cuts came across under Ford, but he did get some of the budgets sort of in order. In Toronto, it's near impossible to do. But really, his actions and response to being caught by the media really, really derailed everything for him at City Hall.
Henry, a question I will put to you is, do we think mayors are becoming more important? Is it the case that because they are the ones that do the governing that actually matter to the people, that matters rather to people who live in cities, that they should be granted perhaps even more power than they already have?
I think mayors are becoming more powerful relative to heads of state, which are the class of people that we traditionally think of as being the most powerful. But I think that a lot of people are becoming more powerful relative to heads of state, and that includes, you know, CEOs of private companies. And just while I was digging around, looking at kind of mayors and ambassador figures and kind of people on this diplomatic level, and I was just reminded that last year, Denmark appointed an ambassador to Silicon Valley, who was going to be on the same level as their kind of normal diplomatic corps. Techplomacy, they called it. I know you'll enjoy that word, Andrew.
No, and that is a word that has been uttered for the last time on my watch.
A really interesting observation that was made by the Minister for Foreign Affairs in the press release is that companies like Google, IBM and Apple and are so large, I'm quoting him here, their economic strength and impact on their everyday lives exceed that of many of the countries where Denmark has more traditional ties. So I think that, you know, when we're looking around and thinking about who is going to be in a position to be able to make the biggest impact in our lives, make the best policy decisions, the most effective policy decisions over the next century, mayors will play a greater role. But I also think that, as I say, many other actors, including the heads of large companies that are becoming increasingly powerful, will as well.
But I'd like to pick up on that and on the importance of mayors. I do agree with what Henry is saying, but I also think that in political terms and in terms of political career, having had a mayorship under your belt has become more of an important thing or a more positive thing to be able to then progress and become a national leader too. I mean, I'm thinking about Renzi, for example, now, has obviously become prime minister, and many people abroad forget that he was for long mayor of Florence before anything else, and that for a very long time during his premiership, he was by many called the mayor of Florence, and he was appreciated for his, I guess, smaller and more reform-oriented on the practical grounds approach than many other politicians that had occupied the spot before him.
I mean, I have interviewed the current and previous mayors of Tirana in the capital of Albania, which was an interesting case study because, you know, it was basically a city that needed rebuilding from the ground up from the mid-90s onwards. But Edi Rama, who is now the prime minister of Albania, was the one who famously had the entire city painted a whole bunch of bright colours just to try and stir up some kind of discussion of what the urban environment should look like. And his successor, Erion Veliaj, who I saw last time I was in Tirana last year, has expanded on that and has transformed the city utterly. But I think that's what comes of giving somebody in that position the power necessary to do that. Does anyone here have any particular favourite mayors or any examples of mayors that have done a good thing or made a difference to their city?
I was going to name Fordy, but we've already covered him.
Oh, yeah.
Let's be honest.
No, I can, I can go to Iceland, I think, if you'll allow me.
Yeah.
Dagur Egertsson and his team. I guess they're a little bit the...
This is the mayor of Reykjavik?
Yes, indeed. I guess they're a little bit the golden boys of the kind of climate change parade, in as much as they have a bit of an easy course, given all of the geothermal activity and energy that they have in the country. They kind of have it a little bit easier than all of us poor souls who have to find other ways of creating sustainable energy out of other natural resources. But I think what Reykjavik are doing in their attempt to go climate neutral is genuinely interesting, because it doesn't just evolve drain using the natural resources, but also just rethinking the way that the city should be built. I mean, Reykjavik is very low level, very, despite being quite small and with not much population, actually extends quite wide. And they're thinking of re-densifying the whole city, really rethinking the whole structure of it. And I think that's quite brave. And in a country where already, you know, the emissions are not huge, it's not necessarily the top one city that's polluting the planet. But I think it's good that they're willing to take a really radical approach nonetheless.
And just a final thought, and I'll ask you, Daniel. We've discussed Rob Ford as an example of how not to do it. What kind of qualities does a mayor actually need?
I think charisma and a personal touch. I look at someone we've interviewed in Monocle before, Nahed Nenshi. He brought a totally different approach to the mayor's office, in that he wasn't a politician before, and he didn't have to do what Toronto's current mayor now has to do, and that's talk at end as a politician. John Tory turns up everywhere, and you're like, what happened? He's just going on and on about trying to get his talking points out, sort of as Prime Minister Trudeau does now, trying to talk himself out of all these situations. And Nahed Nenshi seems to be a really relatable type guy. I mean, I've been a keen follower as well of someone like Anne Hidalgo in Paris. We're talking about climate and you know, mayors banding together. She's really charged on with trying to transform the urban landscape there and do more greener things for that city, and you know, not really relying on the government at all, just sort of, you know, being a lone wolf.
Okay, well, finally tonight, here in the UK, the Environment Secretary, Michael Gove, has suggested that after Brexit, Britain will be able to get rid of plastic drinking straws, along with what remains of its manufacturing industry, influence on the world stage, and the perception that it is basically a sane nation. It is estimated that the UK uses more than 8 billion of the things every year, contributing a considerable blight on the environment. While we are banning stuff, because I don't really want to get into a discussion of drinking straws, because they suck. That joke, courtesy of Tom Hall, the producer of tonight's program. That was all him. He wrote it right here in the script. But I do want to pretend that the three of you have been endowed with the power to ban things. It's always fun. I have quite a lengthy list, but I am open to suggestions for adding to it. I mean, I just to kick us all off, I would ban... I won't list all several thousand of them. Umbrellas can go, emojis, and all music, except in places where people have specifically congregated for the listening of it. Kiara, what are you going to add?
I do have quite a list. I'm going to give you a few select. Multicolored glasses frames, seeing glasses. What about cash machines that charge you to get cash?
So yes, and
paying money money.
Automatic checkouts in supermarkets.
Yes, but also the cash machines that force you to check your balance. And when you say, yes, I don't want to see my balance, they go, are you sure? Do you really, really not want to see your balance? And I said, no, I don't want to look at it.
So, okay, the passive-aggressive cash machine.
Yeah, and just one more, dry shampoo. Hate it. Just wash.
What, all shampoo?
Dry shampoo.
What's dry shampoo?
Oh, Andrew, you've never been a woman, have you?
No, that is true, Kiara. I have not. I have not.
Dry shampoo is a thing that you spray into your hair when you haven't had time to wash your hair, so that it makes your hair go a little white and powdery, and then it just looks like you've had a shower when really you haven't, and you can go back to the festival looking like you're fine.
Festivals, they're on my list as
also,
well.
Yeah.
Daniel?
I will second the umbrellas, especially in the dense urban environment. In Toronto, there's this plague of people having the giant golf umbrella.
Yeah.
And you're like,
Why? I am on record earlier today on Monocle 24 saying I would ban the kick scooter. I can't stand it.
The kick scooter
is little push scooter.
Stupid little silvery things that human beings ride on.
Like a micro scooter, but now everyone's got them.
Yeah, so it started as kids on the scooters, and I understand that parents are trying to get their kids to school, and they've come up with this amazing way to occupy the children to make sure they're not running into the street and they're in line. But then you've got people scooting to their office. It's all a little bit ridiculous.
For children, it's okay.
Yeah.
Though,
well, see, I would expand the idea you have introduced there, and just put infantilism in general on the list. Like, you know, like corporations that try to be your friend, and mm-hmm. self-consciously arch-knowing wacky advertising, and websites that try to have a conversation with you. Those kind of things.
That was a real person, Andrew.
No. Well, I was a real person that wrote the algorithm that's trying to make me feel good about myself.
I'd also ban web chat and email exchanges with customer service. Can we not just get people on the phone anymore?
No, I'm a big fan of... I would actually ban phones.
Oh, yeah?
Altogether?
Yeah, entirely. Absolutely. And in fact, most forms of communication. Henry.
Radio's okay. We'll keep radio.
I actually err on the side of fascism when it comes to nuisance behaviour. So I would actually go for the full Singapore approach when it comes to most forms of, for example, littering.
So no durians and no gum?
I don't mind the consumption of the products, and I also don't mind skateboards, which I know is a big hang-up out there. But I lose sight of the argument against, for example, fining someone £300 for dropping litter. I just think that behaviourally it behoves us as a society to enforce it. It's so easy not to do, but maybe I'm coming off as very right wing here.
If only our listeners, Henry, could see the manic glint in your eye while you unleash these fantasies of vengeance against people who pollute London's otherwise pristine streets. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Daniel Bates, Chiara Ramella, and Henry Rhys Sheridan, thank you for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Louis Harnett O'Mara. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. There's more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London. I will be your host for that as well. Until then, I'm Andrew Muller. Goodbye. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.